Good afternoon, everyone. It is always a challenge to be the first speaker after lunchtime, so I'm going to try to keep you all awake. But today's session, our panel is about the role of culture and community, renewing social institutions. So I'm going to speak to you briefly about restoring and strengthening the American family. So my main point is that the future of this nation will depend on the strength of its families, measured largely by the restoration of marriage as the cornerstone of American family life. So how do we accomplish such a tall task? By making the case to the current and future generations that marriage is valuable, desirable, accessible, and indispensable for the purpose of family formation. Put simply, we need to embark on a marriage before carriage campaign that is infused in every part of our culture. But before I get into the details, let's first do a little etymological work. So one of the origins of the word culture is the Latin word cultura, which is an agricultural term related to tilling land and the intentional preparation of the earth for fruitful activity. And what holds true in the agricultural realm also holds true in the sociocultural realm. When it comes to creating a marriage and family culture in America, we need to be mindful about the current conditions of our social soil and intentional about planting and watering the things we hope to grow and weeding and pruning anything that threatens our harvest. Marriage has been under attack for decades from actors who sought to change its definition and weaken its foundations through politics and policy, media, academia, and social norms. Therefore, if we want to strengthen the family and fortify the home, we need to get our houses in order. So I'm going to speak to you briefly about four houses: the church house, the schoolhouse, the movie house, and the state house, that represent four distinct yet interrelated aspects of culture, namely religion, education, media, and government. So first we'll go to the church house. So I'm sure everyone is familiar with the idea that politics is downstream from culture. Well, I would argue that culture, specifically the beliefs and values that shape behavior, is downstream from religion. Now, unfortunately, 30% of Americans are now religiously unaffiliated. But religion provides a moral foundation, as well as a lens through which people view the world, and boundaries that govern human behavior. A decline in the importance of religion is one reason marriage is seen as a temporary contract now by many, as opposed to a lifelong covenant. Christianity calls believers to do hard things, including enduring persecution for the sake of the faith. But an irreligious culture that prioritizes convenience over duty produces people who are ready to divorce the moment they think, this relationship isn't serving me anymore. Religious institutions also play a critical role in discipling their members and the broader culture about the reality of male-female sex differences. At a time when being accepted in polite society requires you to affirm that there are more than two genders, churches are needed more than ever to teach that men and women are equal in dignity and worth, but different in form and function. Pastors and priests should be among the loudest voices declaring that androgyny is not equality. It is also important to know that there's a feedback loop inherent in the interaction between faith and family. A recent nationwide survey of 19,000 churchgoers from the nonprofit Communio found that 80% of respondents had continuously married parents through childhood. Now, obviously, correlation does not equal causation, but the authors of this project noted prior research that also has shown that the breakup of the family through divorce often produces religious non-affiliation among children. So, speaking of children, let's make our way over to the schoolhouse. One way to cultivate a pro-marriage society is to introduce the success sequence, specifically to K through 12 students. Now, for those of you who may be unfamiliar with that term, the success sequence refers to research that shows 97% of millennials, so these are adults born between 1980 and 1984, who finish school, secure employment, and marry before having children, avoid poverty by their mid-30s. Now, that is a message that's tangible, that's achievable, and measurable. It's also something that can be introduced to children long before they make the decision to become parents and start a family themselves. The success sequence is more important now than ever because the left is open about its desire to use the classroom for the type of political indoctrination that makes creating a marriage culture extremely difficult. Here is an official statement from New York City Mayor Eric Adams on the Drag Queen Story Hour NYC program. And I quote, "At a time when our LGBT communities are under increased attack across this country, we must use our education system to educate. The goal is not only for our children to be academically smart, but emotionally intelligent. Drag storytellers and the libraries and schools that support them are advancing a love of diversity, personal expression, and literacy that is core to what our city embraces." Now, Eric Adams oversees the largest public school system in the country. There are over 1.1 million students in public schools in New York City. I was one of them. And I can assure you that I did not suffer academically because I graduated before the city began using drag queens as literacy coaches. Now, this is why education choice, specifically through education savings accounts and universal school choice programs, is so important. Choice gives parents the ability to find schools that have high standards and align with their values. Home education is also a key component of getting the schoolhouse in order. It also serves to reinforce the home's telos as a hub of productive, economic, spiritual, social, educational, and relational activity. Education is equal parts scholarship and discipleship, academic mastery and moral formation. It is not a neutral endeavor. So the only question is whose values will be planted in the minds of the next generation. So that brings us to the movie house, again, to represent media and entertainment. Television, film, social media, digital media, and advertising are also important tools for cultivation. We need more positive images of intact families with fathers who love and lead their families, wives who respect and support their husbands, and children who honor their parents. Now, I understand that those types of shows are unlikely to spring up when what we've been planting for decades are bumbling, incompetent fathers, disrespectful children, and reality television that showcases drama between wine moms. That said, conservatives need to continue engaging online and through new media platforms, especially if we want to reach the next generation who are being targeted by both the anti-family feminist left as well as the anti-marriage red pill right. The latter is being fueled by men who tell other men that they should rethink marriage and children and family in a society where women have more economic, political, legal, and cultural power than ever before. But what young men really need to know is that marriage and children give them something both to live and die for. They should not fear forming a family. They should embrace marriage as man's natural habitat and see the important role that they play in establishing the social infrastructure needed for multi-generational success. But in this case, media is not restricted to movies, TV, and podcasts. For instance, any municipal government in the country could choose to take a portion of its human services or child welfare budget and direct it towards a pro-marriage public awareness campaign. They could have simple messages like, give her a ring before she gives you a baby. Or, in this city, we believe marriage comes before carriage. This type of effort could be even more effective if every corporation, small business, professional sports league, entertainer, and athlete promoted marriage the way they promoted social justice, particularly prior to 2020. So our last house is the state house. Conservatives and libertarians are increasingly making a public case for policies designed to strengthen families. Some have pushed for paid parental leave, reforms to the WIC program, and expanding the child tax credit. But family policies that are solely child-focused are well-intentioned, but have limited effect without a specific focus on marriage. Yes, it is good to focus the energies of a mother and father on the needs of their shared child. But marriage also accounts for the duties and obligations husbands and wives have to one another. The pledge of commitment represented in sickness and health is not part of any cohabitation agreement, child support order, or divorce decree that I'm aware of. So a new era of conservatism with regard to the most important institution may require us to choose whether programs that don't deliver our desired results 90% of the time are worthwhile investments. So I know many of you are familiar with the Bush administration's healthy marriage project in the early 2000s. And according to the evaluation published in 2012, those marriage education programs produce marginal, consistent patterns of small positive effects on multiple aspects of a couple's relationship. But imagine, if you would, for a minute, a program, let's say funded by local government with matching funds from a large foundation that provides relationship education training for unmarried couples with children. That program would be administered through a nonprofit organization with support from a local faith-based institution. It would need to address finances, communication, sex infidelity, substance abuse, conflict, etc. Couples who successfully complete the program would have their marriage license fees waived and be eligible for a mass wedding event at a large venue, let's say a stadium or a college. But they would also receive a significant monetary incentive, let's say $10,000. In the form of a loan that would turn into a grant after 7 years, for the seven-year itch, of course. So what if a study done in 15 years shows that only 33% of the couples who started are still married? Would we consider that a failure? If so, perhaps we should rethink how we define success. So some of you may have been wondering what were those loud booming noises last night, around somewhere between 10 and 11. And I happened to look out the window and I saw fireworks. And it didn't make sense until I realized the Cleveland Guardians. Now, when I was a fan, they were the Cleveland Indians back in the 90s. Won last night on a walk-off double. Consider this. A .330 lifetime batting average would make someone one of the best hitters in Major League Baseball history. But a 33% free throw percentage would make them a terrible shooting guard. What's my point? My point is that defining success must be done in the context of the game being played. And marriage cultivation work with low-income couples who don't have a family history of marriage and who have already dealt with infidelity is going to look different than the same work being done with middle-class, highly educated, church-going couples. So in closing, the success sequence is good for students. But with 40% of American births occurring outside marriage and 35% of all unmarried parents now cohabiting, we need a cultivation strategy that includes repair and restoration, not just rhetoric. Thank you.